Hi everyone, I'm Gary Naughton. I'd like to welcome you to this program. Why have we gone so far afield from where we ideally should be as human beings communicating one to another? That is the purpose of today's program. Joining me live in our studio in New York City is an individual who is in a unique position to share his insights on these very topics, because in various ways, through his writings over the many years that I've read his very important works and his teachings at Columbia University, Professor Robert Thurman has been a voice of reason, compassion, sensitivity, but also, make no mistake, he is fully aware that we must raise the passion within ourselves to address injustice. Being passive does not mean that we are subservient, but rather we are even more determined to see that other issues are brought to our attention that right now people seem completely removed from. For example, today on our program, we're going to talk about why does China hold such animus against the Dalai Lama? What is the real history of the relationship between China and the entire Himalayan area that China says it's their territory? And how is that so much different than the Palestinian and Jewish conflict? I do not believe it is so much different in its fundamental principles. Nice to have you with us today.
Oh, nice to be with you, Gary. It's wonderful to be here. Truth, beauty, and freedom. That's what we need.
Professor Robert Thurman holds the Jazong Kapu Apa Robert Thurman Chair of Indo-Tibetan Studies, Columbia University. He is president of the Tibetan House, USA. And he is a dedicated individual in preserving Tibetan civilization, president of the American Institute for Buddhist Studies. The New York Times held him as the leading American expert on Tibetan Buddhism. In 1962, he was ordained as a Buddhist monk by the Dalai Lama, with whom he has been a personal friend to this day. Later, he received his degree and doctorate from Harvard. He is a passionate advocate not only for the rights of Tibetans, but for human rights around the world. And he is sought by policymakers on the Tibetan Holocaust and has testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. And he's also steeped in the dialogue between the exterior Western sciences and the interior science of the mind and consciousness. And in that context, he works towards what he terms a second renaissance, a moving beyond the European discovery of the natural sciences towards a more advanced spiritual science that finds synergies with modern scientific discoveries. When you look at the crisis that we're facing, multiple crises in the world today, how would you define how we got there? Take any of these as examples, and then deconstruct that paradigm. If we look at it as it is today, we don't see it for what it is. We just see some, like in Afghanistan, Petraeus, we need more troops. Obama, well, maybe, maybe not. We're not deconstructing the problems to see, didn't we have the same conversation back in 1969-70 with General Westmoreland, who said to Lyndon Johnson, we must have more troops or we'll lose.
That's right.
And all we had was a lot more dead Americans. And so we're not able to deconstruct. Could you please take us through this?
Well, I don't claim to be a great authority on all of this, but I was just reading yesterday in a class with students on the life of the Buddha, where the Buddha was giving some advice to a king. And the advice, and the king was complaining that although he had a great empire and he had a lot of wealth, there were a lot of brigands and robbers, and the country was infested with disaffected people who were causing a lot of trouble. And the Buddha said, well, you can go out and you can execute a lot of them and imprison them and crush them down, but their survivors will just continue to make this trouble and it'll never work. What you should actually do is give the farmers enough to really do their farming, give the merchants enough to do their business, give everybody, you know, share your wealth with them in such a way that they can get engaged in their occupations and have a stake in the society. And then they'll be fine, you know, rather than trying to suppress. It's like this idea that that people get when they get in power and they get paranoid and they think somehow order means just crushing everybody down and then everything will be fine, and then people keep baking up through the crushing down, and then they get worse and worse. You know, it's like here in America we have over 2 million people in prison, We have a lot of ridiculous laws. More than half of them are completely really innocent of anything except poverty and lack of education. We won't build them schools. We won't let them have decent food. We brainwash them in various ways, and then they act up, and then we arrest them. And yet that doesn't solve any problem at all. In fact, it's much more expensive than if we, even on a sort of utilitarian level, than if we made sure that all the schools were really great from the beginning. So I think that you can trace it way back several thousand years to the sort of choice in societies to go for the sort of military warrior option and think, you know, look at, they still read in schools a classic, as if it were a classic, the Iliad. But the Iliad is a Rambo story. It's just written in Greek, so it sort of sounds nice for literary people. But it's basically a sort of sulky, violent guy, you know, Achilles wandering around, and Odysseus tricks people. He's like the foreign, you know, State Department or something. It's the same story, the military story. And the world's greatest disease today is this militarism, and it goes along with wars in every direction, war on drugs, war on cancer, war, all of them losing wars, because none of these things can be dealt with that way, as of course you know better than I. And the way to turn it around, I think, is that we have to realize the futility of this. I think actually the invention of the atomic bomb, and Einstein himself said, you cannot solve a problem without thinking about it on a different level and with different people than the ones who caused the problem. You know, you can't go back, like right now, for example, the economic thing is an amazing, wonderful thing, that the industrial exploitation of the planet, pollution of the planet has broken down, is actually a lucky thing. We all go around, you know, driving our cars and riding and bad drains here in this country, unfortunately. But we do that, and then we worry, oh, gee, but we're wrecking the planet, but then we just carry on doing it. So the fact that it's broken down before the planet is wrecked is actually a very good thing. But unfortunately, our wonderful revolutionary president, who is a beautiful person, is being brainwashed by these bankers and people that the only thing to do is try to reconstruct Wall Street, whereas Wall Street should be allowed to sink quietly back to 4 or 5% of the economy where it's supposed to be, instead of 20% where it's not supposed to be, and causing every kind of wreckage. If he had given those several trillion dollars of guarantees that were given back to those nasty bankers with their huge bonuses, if he'd given them to the farmers, the family farms, I mean, I don't mean agribusiness, I mean the family farms, the organic farms, if he had given them to the small businesses, if he had paid people's mortgages, paid people's student loans, the young people, instead of starting off with crushing burdens of debt, several trillion dollars would have the country dancing in the street, and people wanting to pay taxes, and people wanting to see things go right, and calling back, like Afghanistan, for example. It's so silly, bombing away and killing more people at weddings and villages and to get one or two, like, maldoers, when the main thing to do, I told Richard Holbrooke this, buy the opium crop ourselves, stop this asinine war on drugs, buy the opium crop, make anesthetic out of it for all the hospitals around the world, which are short of that, and become a patron of all the Afghan farmers, and then slowly shift them over to other crops because the price will go down because it won't be illegal. That will deprive the terrorist types, you know, Taliban types, from the source of their wealth to buy arms, and the few Al-Qaeda who are lurking down in Pakistan, and the Pakistan intelligence services, who are also not part of the solution at all. And that would have will solve it. You can't just bomb everybody out of you know, contention. You have to, like, work with them, talk to them, satisfy them. And it's the same thing. I loved it. I happened to see, I was tired on Saturday night, so I like cartoons. I'm a very childish personality. So I saw The Mummy, The Return of the Dragon King, the Chinese version of The Mummy. And Jet Li was the bad king, you know, who was the mummy rising up. And he was great. He was a great bad guy. And he said at one point, I want perfect order. This freedom leads to chaos. I want to crush everybody down. And he was doing what the Qin Emperor did 2,000 years ago in founding the Qin Dynasty, which only lasted 25 years because he was just oppressing everybody. And the Chinese themselves threw him out. But he was perfectly articulating the philosophy of the so-called people of power on our planet, who are just paranoid people, out of touch with reality, actually, sitting on top of structures that allow them to control the lives, unfortunately, and destiny of the earth and the people. And they just think that they just have to squash everything down. It's like, as Joni Mitchell says, you know, pave over paradise and make it into a parking lot. And that just won't work, and it'll destroy their own lives, in fact, you know, as luckily happened in The Mummy. The Dragon King went back to dust, as he deserved to be. So, I know it's a kind of silly metaphor, but it was so great, and I was proud of Jet Li, because he was mouthing exactly what any dictator says. That, like Mugabe, you know, like the dictators in China, like any would-be dictator here, our Cheneys, you know, who would love to be a dictator. We had a mini moment of a dictator after the coup d'etat in the year 2000 for 8 years, you know, with Karl Rove and vote rigging and the whole thing. And these people just are nuts, and they cannot do anything right, and they destroy themselves, sadly. You know, so we also have to be compassionate for them. We don't need violent revolutions. Violent revolutions produce yet another type of dictator always, because the people who get to the top are more violent than the previous people. We need to continue our peaceful revolution, of which I would say you are one of the great leaders, with your revealing of all the underside of the chemical companies and the food system and the whole thing, which is what is really the health problem around here. It isn't just the insurance companies, as of course you know very well. It is the disturbed, the ruined soil, the ruined water, the bad food system, the preservatives, and the corporate control of our diets, you know, and the way we live, and ruining our children's lives as well. And this is the kind of quiet revolution we need to continue to do. So I'm delighted to be here with you this morning in this house of truth, beauty, and freedom. I'm very, very happy.
Thank you. I really appreciate your overview. Yesterday we had on Rabbi Abraham Lerner.
Michael Lerner, my buddy. I didn't know he was in town. Oh, how wonderful. I love Michael.
And this is a part of our continuation of Conversations with the Remarkable Minds.
Yes.
And we both agree that we must empower people, motivate them, inspire them,
yes,
to realize that they count.
Yes.
They should have their voices heard peacefully,
yes,
but dynamically.
Yes.
And
absolutely.
Where we have a difference of opinion,
mm-hmm,
which we discussed, is that he is the belief that with Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama, they were put in a position where they had inordinate amounts of pressure placed upon them by lobbyists and special interest groups, which then turned them from their earlier promises,
yes,
to look after the interests of the average person,
mm-hmm,
to looking after exclusively the interest of a relatively small 1,200 corporation, more or less,
right,
group of individuals, the Wall Street,
right,
people. And where I disagreed is I believe that in the very nature of power, and I'll show you where I'm going with my question for you.
Okay, okay.
In the very nature of seeking power,
mm-hmm,
over others,
right,
you don't do it naively. You first find out, how am I going to get into power?
Uh-huh.
Who's going to support me?
Uh-huh.
And what do I need to do when I'm there?
Mm-hmm.
George Bush, and he rightly said, George Bush could care less what people said. If there were 10 million people in the streets protesting, he wouldn't care. He'd turn the channel. And Cheney also would just become more defiant, wiretap all these people. They're all enemies of the state. You know, put them on, they're all potential terrorists.
Yeah.
How dare they? Let's change the Constitution. My feeling is, however,
mm-hmm,
and this is merely a subjective feeling, that the Clintons and Obama come from that school of thought that they are bright, well-educated,
mm-hmm,
and Princeton, Yale, Harvard,
right,
and that they grow up with,
mm-hmm,
they associate with, they,
mm-hmm,
communicate with, not the average person, but a select group of people who are like them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's an enculturation process.
Mm-hmm.
I could show you the same process and same groups down on Wall Street who will make money without ever thinking, is this money being made hurting anyone?
Mm-hmm.
And then you have another group who, in education, will say, we don't care what the students want to know.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to tell them what they need to know from our perspective. Now, they,
right,
can be completely well-intentioned.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I'm suggesting that the people that we have been electing into positions of power,
mm-hmm,
through all of our presidential campaigns are the wrong people.
Mm-hmm.
And then when we do have a Barack Obama, the left tries to apologize for the pressure that he has been under and the compromises he has made. And I went back and looked at his voting records, and the time he was in the legislature in,
mm-hmm,
in Illinois,
mm-hmm,
he's always voted pro-corporate, corporate theocracy, and he has not been a populist person, whereas Ralph Nader was truly, and some constitutional and green candidates were truly different. They would not have put us into Afghanistan, got us out of Iraq, wouldn't have had the crash on Wall Street, wouldn't have eviscerated the Glass-Steagall Act, wouldn't allow commodity tradings in something essential as food, wouldn't have supported the genetic engineering people over organic, would have bailed out the very people you suggested.
Right.
And yet we reject, as a society, we reject Ralph Nader, we reject true progressives, but the moment someone comes up looking like Rambo with enormous political steroids, who gives us absolute confidence and certainty, we're going there, we're going to kill these people, bomb these, then people can't line up quick enough. What is it saying? Here's my question then, and please take your time on this.
Yes.
What does it say about how we select the people to help guide us in our processes? Why do we, as a nation, consistently reject those who are spiritual in temperament and action and are fearful of people like the Dalai Lama? And fearful of people like Martin Luther King.
Right.
Remember, you forget how many people didn't like King or Gandhi. Why do we not support truly spiritual, dynamic people instead of merely those who wrap the cloak of religiosity around themselves? Well, that's my thought.
First of all, I just want to say that I think we still have to cut Obama a certain amount of slack. I think that the view that you articulate, which is a perfectly valid view, that both parties are really the same party and we've reached a stage where we don't have democracy anymore, which I actually tend to agree with. But I think their choice for this time were the Clintons. The fact that Obama broke through, in spite of all of his things, because of who he is and his background, I think with Barack Obama, I mean, a Muslim name in the middle of this, the other people are into this endless war, Islamo-fascism, they have these insane statements and things like that. They're really into some sort of crusade, really, all of them. The fact that he broke through is itself something revolutionary, but it was not sustained because the people who got on their cell phones, the young people who went out there, then they are not giving their $10 to $5 and their $2, and they're not down in Washington, and they think now he's supposed to take care of it and it's slipping back into the system. And what we have to remember is, I think there was a moment when in 1932, for example, when Roosevelt really began to change the system, and he shut down bankers and he did a lot of things that they've been trying to unravel, and with Reagan they more or less did unravel 50, 60 years later. And we need to go back to that moment, but we have to remember the crash in that time of irresponsible madness was in 1929, and Roosevelt began to repair in 1932, 1933. It took a lot longer to make people face reality and get out of being brainwashed. And also the system of brainwashing was much less powerful than it is now with the electronic thing. But on the other hand, the electronic thing that we have, the interconnectedness of everybody, makes things us able to change things more powerfully today, but it will take time. You know, Nader, I respect and admire Ralph Nader tremendously until 2000. I thought when he stuck in there stubbornly instead of throwing his votes with Gore, which would have made a margin where we would have avoided the coup d'etat. I think Rove at that time didn't have the voting machines rigged well enough, and Jeb Bush in Florida and places like that, that they could have actually swung it and stolen the thing the way they did, in 2000. And Ralph's refusal to acknowledge his role there, the theory that lesser of evils is not really a difference, we have to crash the whole system and then something else will arise, I think that's very mistaken. It's like Wilhelm Reich is a great hero of mine, in the 20th century, and he railed, I believe, very effectively against the German socialists in 1932 who boycotted the election and allowed the Nazis to get in and form a government. And, of course, the world knows what happened because of that, So I do think that our system, for all its imperfections, we do have at least somewhere under the ground, we have the idea that there should be equality, that the legislator people should represent their constituents and not their contributors, which is what has happened now. They just fool their constituents and then represent their contributors. And so we do have still somewhere the leverage if people would wake up and get out of the television daze that they're all stuck in, as they did for a brief moment. I think people were shocked that Obama won. Everybody thought that he would be crushed by Hillary first, and second, crushed by the Republican, you know, dirt machine. And he beat them all, which means we beat them all. So we do have that capacity. Then we kind of sit back and, okay, now he's going to take care of it. You know, I think the ones who normally don't vote, you know, the ones who are taught that they don't matter and they don't mean anything, you know, we still have a system where if people are awakened from that, they do mean something. But now, coming to Harvard, Princeton, Yale, since I'm not there, but I'm at Columbia, although I went to Harvard, I agree with you there. We fail. These bright people that you mention, they are not trained in self-conquest. They are not educated to understand their mind. They don't meditate to lower stress in themselves. They don't learn ethics in a certain way where they would then resist the blandishments of lobbyists and people like that and realize the ethical thing about it. Therefore, they don't change the government system that they benefit from and so on. They go to Congress to enrich themselves. They don't go there to represent the people, almost all of them, unfortunately. And that's the ruinous thing of our system, which is a theocracy, but the god is mammon, you know, money is the god. And that's the problem with this sort of secular democracy and the inattention to spirituality that we have. Just because, I mean, it's a good thing we have secularism in our schools in the sense that we don't have a moral majority kind of Christian fanatics controlling our schools, although most of our schools were founded by Christian fanatics. In fact, Harvard, they all were, most of them. But they don't control them now. On the other hand, that there would be a non-denominational spirituality and that people would learn to cultivate their good heart. Dalai Lama puts it, when he got honorary degree at Columbia, he said, "Thank you very much for the honorary degree." He said, "I love getting honorary degrees because I don't have to do anything to get them." You give it to me for nothing, but that's great. And I admire, and education is the absolutely crucial thing in the world for the nature of life and society, that people know what reality is the Buddhist key thing. But it's not like a non-rational sort of believe something against reason. Buddhism tries to be as reasonable as possible, you know, that as you can be. But he said, "But I do worry about the type of education here," he said, "because what you do here is you educate a clever brain, but you don't educate a good heart. And a clever brain without a good heart can even be dangerous to the person with it and to others, of course. They will exploit others and things like that. So you have to think of how to broaden your educational system to develop the ethics of a person, their sensitivity to others, undo their prejudices and their fanatic views and their, you know, their egotism. And that way, then, you're really doing something." And I've taught for 40 years in universities like Columbia. I've taught at Harvard and everywhere, Amherst College, a little waspy place. And I feel I failed my students all along because I had to subscribe to the tenets of the system. I couldn't teach them to meditate. I couldn't teach them to deepen their way of understanding. Intellectually, I could teach them something about the futility of egotism and exploitation and selflessness and selfishness and so on. But I couldn't teach them to really deepen that in their mind. You know, they would come to me and say, "Oh, I want a guru. I want to do something." I would say, "No, that's not our job here. You're learning about it. When you go out of the world, you may find some people who will help you with your spirituality. You should do that." And even I agree with Dalai Lama. People should, if possible, find those spiritual and ethical, you know, messages from within their own traditions, then sort of switching, so we're not trying to convert anybody to anything, you know, because then that just re-encourages the fanatics that there's, you know, that everybody's like them, you know. They should do it within their own system, we think, you know. So I'm a little worried about I think the critique that you make and that Nader makes is good and should be, but when he went overboard and said Gore was just the same as Bush, I think that's where I a little bit, you know, I don't know Ralph, if I saw him, I would really chastise him for that, you know, just in a friendly manner if I could, because that really was not correct. I think Gore, yes, the military-industrial complex is terribly powerful because of Al-Qaeda. They might have gone anyway to Afghanistan under Gore, but never would Gore have gone into Iraq, for example. And we wouldn't be having the problem now in Afghanistan if we had. The real problem, of course, in Afghanistan is not Afghanistan, it's Pakistan. And it was created by us by arming the religious fanatics in Pakistan, they really used our help to develop ways of attacking India. That's their whole thing. They don't care about Qaeda or Pakistan or anything. They really against India. And India actually is the other great democracy on the planet. That's the one we're supposed to be. And really, that's our natural friend there, you know. And we've been playing some stupid game with Pakistan for 50 years and ruined the country because of their pretense that they're helping us against the Russians originally and against this and that. So we created that, and that we could have solved if it hadn't been for this completely asinine Cheney Bush plan for a new American century to conquer Eurasia, you know, from Iraq, from the Persian Gulf all the way to Siberia, which, you know, ringing Russia, which is the stupid thing they did, blowing the achievement of the end of the Cold War, which was really a Russian achievement. It wasn't Reagan's achievement, where we really could have had alliance and peace with the Russians, which would have quieted down the Chinese, would have quieted down any religious fanatics, and would have quieted down, would have brought Russia to help us to solve the issue with Israel, which is, of course, a real problem with all the Muslims. And Bush 1 blew that totally, in that they just used it as they just kept attacking Russia, really, under the table. And then we got Putin back in Russia. So it's difficult to deal with the Russians. But the Russians are really our people. They're really very, you know, wonderful people. They're ahead of us, actually, in many ways. They've suffered more than we have. And we have a lot to learn from them and should have worked with them really closely. And instead, now we're our military-industrial complex likes it. Now they have several possible enemies to choose from to keep up their big budget. And that's really terrible. But you know what, Gary? I have to be hopeful. You know, Buddha's discovery was that the world is made of happiness, actually. It isn't just we're pursuing it, like Jefferson kind of allowed us after some complaining, the pursuit of happiness, you know, which is a wonderful that it's in our constitution. But they didn't say we could catch it, just pursue it. You know, never catching it, I think, is the deferred gratification of the Protestant ethic, you know. But the thing is that Buddha discovered happiness. You know, the third noble truth was really his discovery, that if you really understand yourself, you conquer yourself, not others, and then you will be happy, actually. You'll find out that the human heart is adapted to reality, and the brain can understand it and itself. And reality is filled with abundant energy if you understand it. If you don't think it's some freaked out thing and fight with it, if you harmonize with it, it's really marvelous. Reality is. And even if you have to fast half the time. So that was his discovery, sort of that underlying everything is an abundance of energy for all. And built on that insight, then you can have a more relaxed approach to solving problems, because even you die, you're not that afraid of dying, because death will embrace you with a positive energy. You know, you don't have to fear hell, and you don't have to fear some terrible, nasty, patriarchal vision of God is going to throw you in some horrible place. You can just be, therefore, because goodness is what reality is around you, you can be good more easily and more fearlessly. And I think that is where I see us as making progress, actually. If you look back at some movie of people in the 50s or 40s or 30s, they look like tinker toys, you know. They're just toddling around, oh, let's make an A-bomb, oh, let's fight somebody. I mean, they were like much more unaware. The men were completely unaware of what the women were doing. Nobody would be dressed like in a relaxed manner. And you know, nobody would, they were just like this, you know. And they were caught in the industrial machine. Charlie Chaplin, Modern Times, right, with his mustache wheeling around in the cogs in a wheel, remember? And whereas now, you know, we listen to our wives, or we try to. We dress a little better. We have a half, actually, he's not really black. He's half white, too. We have a mixture in the White House, a wonderful hybrid, you know, with a Muslim name and a father from Africa. I mean, it's incredible that we have this. And we have this huge flood of information. Unfortunately, too much skewed by corporate control, but it's still an immense flood that people know subliminally, you know, about the nature of the world. And we care for our children in a new way, and we want to let them bring out their things. And we won't tolerate the suppression of women in other cultures. We try not to, anyway. And we're trying to, you know, we still haven't ratified the ERA here because of corporate brainwashing. You know, they want to pay the women. But we'll get there. So it's, in a way, since the 60s, and I know you had your things happen, I'm sure, in the 60s, I did. We've been going on a social level and a cultural level in a good direction. And that's what that energy reared its head in the Obama moment. It's the initial Obama moment. And, you know, we knew that was the lesser of evil, the best we could get at that time. And then everybody really jumped in a new way, and then easily dominated once they really move and they get off their butt, all of us. And then on the surface, these loonies from the World Wars are still like trying to dominate everybody and arrest everybody and crush everybody and have them drink a cocktail and then can't smoke a joint or whatever it is, you know. And they're going to go to prison for life, you know, if they relax, you know. And so it's like an amazing moment of confluence of total madness on the top of a few crazy people. And their own complete incompetence, I think, is a sign of their feeling that they don't really have traction in the people's hearts. They're doing more desperate, nasty things to them. You know, like someone like Limbaugh, how can he even be allowed to spew lies over the air and people have all these ditto heads run around and scream at town halls? I mean, why isn't there a rule about lying on the air? There used to be a fairness doctrine abolished by Reagan, actually. Right? He couldn't have spewed, like, you know, the Clintons killed Nelson Foster. I mean, whatever insane things he said. Obama is born in Africa. God knows what he says, you know. It's just all lies, you know. And this is where we've lost it, that with those top people. But they're doing it in such a clown-like way that I think now we will change our choices. We show that we can. And it's simply we have to sustain that. Michael Lerner. Look at him. He's gone up against AIPAC for decades. They call him a self-hating Jew. Meanwhile, he's a very good rabbi. You know, he's a wonderful rabbi. But he sees freedom. He sees that the militarists in Israel are destroying Israel, actually. The peace people would give Israel a chance. But the military ones are destroying it by creating such a hatred around it. You cannot live in the midst of such a hatred. You know, it's impossible. Even walls are never high enough. So I think it's important that we visualize the hopeful. Like my recent book, I wrote, you know, how the Tibet-China issue, which you said you want to talk about, can be solved totally positively. And when people read my book, not that many have, but, you know, it's done fairly well. And what I'm so happy when they read it and they say to me, you know, wow, you know, I didn't realize that actually it could happen. You know, that the right thing could happen for Tibet. China could do the right thing for Tibet. And stop doing the wrong thing for Tibet and stop trying to genocide them in the way that they've been doing. And it would be to China's benefit. I never realized that. I always thought China would lose terribly. You know, they have this fantasy about Chinese people losing face, you know. And so therefore they're not like grown-ups. They can't take a fault on the, you know, they can't take on board a fault and see themselves self-critically because they would lose faith, which is nonsense. Look at Cheney losing face or Bush or any of our insane leaders. They can't lose face either. And it's not a Chinese thing, you know. And then everyone can when they have to, you know. And so they say to me, by seeing how China would gain by being humane and intelligent and aware of the need and seeing the perspective of the others involved, they would gain. The Israelis, by lowering the wall, by getting out of the West Bank, by befriending the Palestinians, by spending all that huge billions of dollars of subsidy they get from us and from around the world on making the Palestinians happy, they would get back to where the Jews were with the Muslim people for thousands of years. The Muslims were not their problem. The crazed Christians were their problem, but not the Muslims. You know, the Roman Christians are the ones who originally kicked them out of their homeland and everything. And the Muslims just lived there alongside with them. And there are wonderful Jewish quarters in Baghdad, in Cairo, in Marrakesh, in Sarajevo. You know, when they were thrown out of Spain by Ferdinand and Isabella, they went in the Ottomans, the Turkish Muslim Ottomans gave them great jobs and happy living in Sarajevo. And in other Turkish cities and things. So this whole fake idea that they can only live if they've killed all the Muslims and kicked them all out into Jordan or something that the right wing in Israel has promoted and now controlled the entire agenda in America and there is simply a delusion, and they are actually being self-destructive. And they are causing this hatred, and they are endangering their own people, in other words, rather than protecting them. So I think that, you know, that we have to go in a way where we work with what we've got there, and we try to keep the people mobilized. And I think that's what is happening. I think nature is rising up to help us. It's just that it will take, we have a 2009 crash. That is, you know, 2008, 2009, total crash. We really had it. We're really in a different ballgame now. We're not really, this fake stock market pump up now, it's not real. It won't work. People are still out of their houses, out of their jobs. We're finished, actually, in the old way. And it just has to sink in. And then we will really empower Obama and Obama-type people. Who, yes, the other thing I think we have, we mustn't confuse one thing. Obama tries to get along with his opponents. He tries to talk to these lunatics. You know, he got a little heated when the guy said, "You lie," and he used the word lie himself, which is good. And I think he will get a little tougher like Roosevelt did, you know, just pass the thing with his majority and that's it. But you know, he's trying to deal with the enemy. Like, you know, it is the Buddhist thing. The people who are evil, you know, the evildoers, we have to try to love them. That's the difference between the inner revolution and the cool revolution and the social revolution and the American, the real American revolution, which wants to include everybody, the one that you are a powerful leader of, and not these idiots with the in the Congress with their limousines and their whatever, their Hummers, you know. But you in your little studio here is the one who's the leader of the real revolution, and that revolution, you know, has to project. The one danger I think of the opponent, the dissident, the left, you know, which at the moment is to get into a thing where somehow we don't think it will work. Nothing, it will never work. We're sort of a voice in the wilderness and we won't be heard. And we drop the idea that we could actually succeed. Do you know what I mean? We lose track of that idea. And I think that's a little bit what happened to Nader, because he knows so well the nastiness of the corporate mindset and the structure of it. And he's such a hero in fighting it, but at a certain, he also did go to Princeton, don't forget. And so he got a little stuck, he was going to be a big runner himself, and he wouldn't stop and throw his votes to Gore. And even, I wrote him and Gore emails, because Gore was just as bad, and I said, make Ralph the Minister of the Interior.
That would have solved the problem. Let me interject.
It would have avoided Iraq, which
that's
was
correct.
Yeah.
I would have appointed Dennis Kucinich to an important position.
Absolutely.
Cynthia McKinney. I would have put the leading voices of progressive causes in the Obama administration. Now, just two quick personal points.
Yes.
Then the question about India and Pakistan, China and Tibet, Israel and Palestine are coming up next.
Yes.
My own two points. We mistakenly believe that the President of the United States is the most powerful force on earth.
That's a mistake.
That is a mistake. It's the corporate interest.
Yes.
The people who actually say who is in our interest, who is not.
Yes.
Now, when a person becomes president, that is one spokesperson for the platform. But you have a Democrat platform, you have a Republican platform. So whatever that administration is going to be, you're going to see it in their platform.
Yes.
Because that's how the people within that Democrat or Republican group say, we will vote for you. We will support you if you do these platforms.
Yes.
And that's how they separate out those that will and those that won't.
Yes.
Now, there are over 6,000 appointments.
Yes.
Once the president takes office. These are the worker bees. These are each heads of departments who themselves in the corporate world or academia have been policy makers. They are sought because the uniqueness of their insights, the power of their persuasion.
Uh-huh.
They in turn bring a whole nother group in that work
for them. That's right.
So when Rubin came in from Goldman Sachs being its president,
please.
All right,
yes.
Under Clinton, he brought in Larry Summers.
Yes, and Geithner.
And Geithner, both came in. They began deconstructing Glass-Steagall. Remember, it was under Clinton that they...
Oh, I know. They caused the problem.
That opened up the credit default derivatives and all this. Casino capitalism. Now, each one of those major players generally has a very strong ego, a sense of importance, and believes they are as smart as the president. In the case of Bush, they were right. God, man, everybody was. But they are the real power, because every day the president, who does not have the time because of the enormous schedule, but mainly being the persona that keeps the public mollified and encouraged, they're the ones who actually sit and create policy.
Yes.
They take their policies.
At the moment, yes.
Yeah, they take these policy positions in with all their research and say, here's what we've got to do with Afghanistan. Barack Obama's not going to go to Afghanistan. He's not going to go around and talk with everyone. He's going to talk with his field commanders, the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the general command there, Petraeus.
Well, he's not talking to you and me.
That's
the problem.
Correct. Here is the problem. When you talk about Obama, it is absolutely unfair for me or anyone else to challenge Obama unless at the same time we understand the context of the enormous influence of individuals that have on him, because they're the ones seeing him every day and telling him this is what we must do.
Yes.
He must then be trusting those people.
Yes.
Now, here is the solution from my point of view.
Okay.
We, who want a truly more democratic and spiritual
progressive.
And
mm-hmm.
progressive movement,
mm-hmm.
we must let the president know in the most conscientious and loving way,
yes,
that we want true progressives around
yes,
him.
Yes.
I've looked at the top 100 appointments. There's
yes.
not one progressive in there.
Yes, it's
there are those
tragic.
Who call themselves progressive. You look like he got this guy who said to Michael Taylor, oh, he's progressive. Are you kidding? He worked for Monsanto. He was
I
the
know.
Biggest supporter
you mean
of...
Vilsack? You mean also in agriculture, Vilsack? He was a big
yes.
Monsanto guy, too.
Yes. So
I know. I was distraught when I saw that.
But that's because Ron Emanuel and the corporate people who
sure.
are in that inner circle, they say you're going to select this person from the defense, that person from education, that person from commerce, that person from energy.
Right.
So the people that are now the full core, the actual mortar and brick
right.
of this administration are all corporatists.
I agree with you.
The thousands of
yes.
individuals like yourself
yes.
and many others who could be their giving voice
yes.
in each area
we're not
are not
Cornel
embodied.
West is not there. Michael Lerner is not there.
That's correct. Could you imagine?
And me.
Could you imagine if you and Cornel West and others were allowed to talk with him about what you would do in the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
Yes.
No more money until you get rid of the settlements, tear down the walls,
yeah.
and create a cooperative environment
yeah.
where you finance new industry. You have ways of saying, what do we as Arabs, what do we as Jews have in common? We are human beings.
Sure. There are already people
doing that. We love our children. You love your children.
Yes.
Why can't we respect the basics of life
yes.
and build from there? We're not doing that.
I know.
And the people
but listen,
are not doing
listen,
it.
Gary,
so
Gary,
that would be my suggestion.
I totally agree with you, but here's where I am still, I could be still suffering under a delusion. My wife often tells me I do. And but what I think is that he said when he got in and people were starting complaining right away, he said, this giant, it's like a giant ocean liner, can't turn it on a dime, he said. And it has to slowly swing, you know those big boats, the way they turn, you know. And then his group systematically down, except for Valerie Jarrett and a few close people who were, and Michelle. Now, Michelle was in Washington the other day, I heard it on the weekend, at a farmer's market buying different organic food. She has an organic garden in the White House lawn that is not filled with chemicals, and they were mad, actually, the industries, and they were complaining about it. And there is this thing there, and those people are having a run at it in the more conventional manner, but they're clearly failing. There's going to be a turnover here. We do have the guy, unless something terrible, you know, God forbid, Buddha forbid, happens to him, he will realize that this is not going to work, because the key is we're in a different moment in the planet, in history.
The progressives
will
select
not
someone
work.
Else.
The corporate people have choked themselves to death. They cannot survive in the way they are doing. The Monsanto people have made the farmers too upset, and they're out of the game, really. Actually, they still have a lot of money and power, but they cannot prevail in this way. This is 1929, remember. It is not 1932 yet. It's 1929. 2012 is the end of the world, remember, according to the Mayans. But it's the end of Monsanto, really, not the world. Monsanto, NBC, these sort of corporate, quote-unquote, corporate, and particularly the worst thing. We would be way ahead right now if the FCC, if he would get... Now, you've been watching the appointments. I have not... I get too stressed out. I'm busy myself. I didn't watch. But the FCC has to reinstate corporate deconstruction and corporate re-pluralization, and the corporate monopolies have to be broken. That is where the brainwashing propaganda media comes from now, and the lack of news, true investigative reporting, and that has to be restored. That's the first step to be restoring and start catching all these people. And I don't know if he's moved in that direction with the FCC, but it couldn't be worse than Powell's son and all the Reagan appointees and the Bush appointees. It must be, there must be one or two progressive creeping in to begin to look at the FCC and the monopolies in the media, so that your voice can be magnified. Why aren't you at an equal level of spread in the country as Limbaugh to at least speak back? Why aren't I? I'd be happy to get out there and, like, have a producer who would read what Limbaugh says and go after him. Franken, in a way, is silenced by being in the Senate. He was there on Air America. Now, Air America looks like they have no funding. It looks all completely, I don't know what they're doing. You get a religious guy on there preaching sometimes when you turn it on.
No, it sounds like an infomercial, unfortunately.
I know. So because they don't have the funding. So where's George Soros? Why isn't he backing a counter Limbaugh on our side, you know? But I think that the key is they sat back. They got Obama in by miracle. And then everybody sat back and said, okay, great, we got a progressive in. And now they're beginning to see, and they're beginning to see, oh, maybe he tricked us. But he didn't trick. You know, the one person who learns the powerlessness of the president most deeply, that lesson, is the president. Especially if they come in with some ideals, they learn that they are paralyzed in there. And he's not going to accept that. I don't think so.
I'm hopeful. I would love to see a renaissance in the progressive movement.
Yes. And we're going to make one. We are making one.
By bringing all of the progressives from all fields together.
Yes.
And of which there are thousands.
Yes.
And saying, look, let us all work together for common good.
Yes.
Let's say Obama is a progressive.
Yes.
But got into office and didn't appreciate how quickly he could be surrounded by non-progressives.
Exactly.
And now he is the person who's been put into a straitjacket politically.
Yes.
Let us take off the straitjacket. Let us work first towards empowering him.
Yes.
And we can do that by he following some of the progressive agendas in education, in the military-industrial complex, and getting out of these wars. But let us give him policy papers.
Absolutely.
We can do that.
Yes.
That's something proactive we can do
totally
today.
I totally agree. And Gary, just to a note of hope, note that the minute it was clear he was going to be elected, they pulled the plug on the finance, and they sucked down $1 trillion or $2 and took it out of his use. By like doing, and then Paulson, this Bush guy, you know, and they went in and they started throwing this money at the banks and everything to keep it out of being able to be used for progressive purposes. So as he was like doing his transition team, they were like stripping all the money out of the system. And
but he's not a banker; he had to rely upon
exactly.
people that he
exactly. So
trusted.
Then they said to him, "Oh, we can fix this. This is, of course, not your fault. We'll have it all fixed up." And naturally, he's like stuck. He felt stuck. So he was trapped and bushwhacked, actually.
Okay,
he was bushwhacked. It's a weird word. Remember, he was bushwhacked before he got in even to office. And the minute they knew he'd be elected, that proves that they consider him a threat, actually.
Well, let us now work let us work towards the liberation.
Absolutely.
Of Barack Obama.
That's it. Baraka.
Okay? Let us liberate the president.
Let's liberate him.
All right? From the shackles of the theocracy and the inverted totalitarianism that is common there.
Yes.
Now, for the three questions we still have remaining.
All right.
The first one ties in with something that you just mentioned. One of the myths that we have as a society is that we are a peaceful society.
Uh-huh.
We are nonviolent.
Uh-huh.
We are a loving and giving society.
Mm-hmm.
As individuals, I believe in all of those as our authentic self.
Mm-hmm.
But I also know what we have become, many, not all, as a conditioned self.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at the most popular programs on television, they are ones of violence.
That's true.
The movie is violence.
Mm-hmm.
The radio, most popular radio show in the world is Rush Limbaugh. And right behind that is Sean Hannity and Glenn Beck.
Right.
Now, this is the most popular radio show in the internet in the world, 10 million listeners.
Right.
And for progressives, but their audiences are commercial. They have all these corporations. You start adding up the total number of people that listen to to their radio shows.
Right.
You're dealing with almost 30 million people.
Right.
Now, then you start looking at television.
Yes.
Bill O'Reilly dwarfs any network show. And again, look how he handles issues, sometimes fairly, sometimes not.
Right.
And I'm thinking, okay, let me put this in perspective. We say we're a nation of peace, yet we never question any of the hundreds of incursions over the decades into other democracies so that we get our way, irrespective of whether we have to assassinate or do what we do. We say that we are a spiritual nation, yet I don't see the spirituality. I see a lot of religion.
Right.
with a lot of dogmas,
right,
of hell and damnation,
right,
and especially those who are the rapturists and the,
right,
and the that they believe Obama is the Antichrist, stupid thing. But again, if you had a conversation with these people, they actually believe this.
I know that. I know.
So how do you look right now at what many of us have actually become by what we do,
right,
versus what we should be doing,
right,
and liberating again the authentic spiritual self? That's my first issue.
Okay, well, what I would like to say is this. The reason that Limbo has this audience is that he's on 1200, you know, clear channel stations, and you know, Murdoch is backing him, and these billionaires are backing him, supporting him. So therefore he can reach these people. We have you and I have a reach of a few tens of thousands, maybe 100,000 on a good day of some complete miracle, and we're not getting on the networks, and we're not getting on Oprah. Now where is there are progressive billionaires who have put a lot of money, tens of millions, hundreds of millions into a campaign, who supported Obama. There are progressive billionaires on this planet, and there are people outside America who have billions. And where's the $1 billion to get Air America really real? The type of thing like Air America on AM, on FM, five stations like that, and buy back some of these places, and short of the FCC changing to break up these media monopolies, buy back some stations from Clear Channel or start some new station. Where's the $1 billion? $1 billion ain't what it used to be. There's no point of them sitting hanging on to it with the trillions of dollars printed by Bernanke and these people. The money will inflate for sure coming up in the next year or two very badly. Actually, the big danger is that it inflates so badly it gets like Weimar Germany. That's very, very dangerous. And that could be also part of the plan, unfortunately, you know, so of the negative plan. So I'm saying, where you say, I agree with you, but it will come from our hearts. And in a way, you know, Allen Ginsberg, I was very fond of Allen Ginsberg, although I was also shocked by him here and there, but I was very fond of him. And a wonderful poem he wrote in the early 70s during the Nixon and Kissinger were bombing even more in Cambodia and in Vietnam, pointlessly and meaninglessly and atrociously, you know. But he just said that at one point he decided that the Vietnam War was over. He personally decided. So I think the way we start, Gary, is we decide that we're going to remain patient and good-humored about more disasters that these people inflict. We're going to see the half full every time and every way we can, while completely not ignoring the half empty and describing it in excruciating detail again and again and again to keep people moving. But we're always going to balance that by seeing the half full and pushing the half full. And we're going to be the liberals and progressives surrounding Obama, because we are surrounding Obama. And, you know, Valerie Jarrett may listen to us. Michelle may listen to us. Maybe his daughter will listen to us. We will somehow mobilize people by having such a positive view of it that we will be not, you know, we will like constantly send an email and a text message to Al Franken every day to be humorously rude to Blue Dog Democrats, for example, and get a real majority to pass things over the lunatics. You know, pass useful things. I mean, we will do whatever it takes. You know, we're doing it as best we can under our underfunded, undermanned operations, and we will keep appealing to the ones who have still something left before all power is taken away from them, to do the right thing with it.
Professor Robert Thurman, my guest, Conversations with Remarkable Minds. Go to GaryNall.com to download this program. It's free and non-commercial. And the title of your new book, second, is
that Why the Dalai Lama Matters, His Act of Truth as the Solution for China, Tibet, and the World. That's the Gandhi, Martin Luther King, Thoreau, you know, nonviolent, Tolstoy, nonviolent act of truth, you know.
We look forward to that. I look forward to our next conversation together.
Me too, Gary. It's great. Been great visiting with you. Thank you.
I want to thank all of you for watching, and I look forward to our next conversation.